Hello and welcome back to yet another episode of the VCpreneur podcast, a podcast that provides a unique perspective of the startup world through the lens of venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. I'm your host Digjay, and today I have with me Smita Diora, co-founder and co-CEO at Lead School. Lead provides schools with a world-class curriculum and an integrated tech platform for all stakeholders in a school environment. Lead is one of the fastest growing edtech startups in the country and currently serving 5,000 plus schools in 500 plus cities. In this episode, Smita talks about her path leading up to Lead School, the genesis phase and what led Smita to make this her life's work, how Lead plans to radically improve the state of education in India by transforming schools, the growth playbook and key challenges faced when building a scalable B2B product. What should founders focus on when hiring the core team for a mission-driven startup like Lead? Smita's fundraising experience, Lead's criteria to select their investors and the value add from each of them, how being an entrepreneur has influenced Smita's personality over the years, and more. This was a special conversation with Smita and one of the most inspirational chats I've had on the show so far. So much passion, clarity of thought, and phenomenal heads-down execution over the past decade. I hope you enjoy this conversation too. So, without much ado, let's jump in and find out what Smita has to share. Hey Smita, welcome to the VCpreneur podcast. Excited to have you with us today. Thank you so much, first of all, for taking out the time.
Hi Digjay. Thanks so much. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
No, likewise. It's going to be a cracking conversation. I have, some very tough questions lined up. Hopefully, you'll tackle it along the way. But, for our listeners who don't know you yet, maybe we can start with a brief background about yourself.
Sure. I think that's, that's a great way to start. And I hope the questions don't get too tough. I'll do my best. Quick background about myself. Grew up in a very normal middle-class family. My parents and one sibling, mostly in Mumbai. I did my CA because when I was studying CA, engineering and medicine were the only three things that one could do. And I chose the path of CA and I, joined Procter & Gamble. This was back in 1999 or 2000. And, I spent 9 years with the company in finance. And a large part of that I spent in Singapore. So I think going out and living in Singapore, of course, was personally very enriching. I think the interesting thread from there is while I was working in finance and I was doing what I was doing in P&G, I always felt that this is not my calling. I'm doing this because, this is a great career. It's a good thing. I get to have a good life because I can have savings. But I always knew that it has to be something else that I do. I didn't know what it was. The trigger for that was for us to move back to India. My co-founder, Sumit, and he's also my partner in life, has grown up in a family of teachers. So ever since we were together, education was always a part of the our conversation. What's happening with kids, what's happening with education was always a part of our household conversation. And, we were going to have our first child and our commitment to us having kids was that we wanted to do something, which was really good for their education. And in 2007, two things converged. One is his desire to move back to India. We always wanted to come back here and also and do something in education. And also our first child was going to be born towards the end of 2007, early 2008. So we moved back here. And I think that is where things got triggered for me personally. So the first thing was that, for those who are not aware, Singapore, there are these PISA assessments that are done internationally. These are international standard assessments on skills that are done. And for many years now, countries have been participating and there are rankings that are shared worldwide to basically share the quality of the education system. Singapore is amongst the top 10 PISA ranked countries for many years. India in 2009 was, or the year before, sorry, had taken the PISA assessment for the first time and the only time. And we were number 72 out of 73 countries that participated. So when we were moving back, I was very aware of the fact that, our desire to be in India basically means that I'm going to raise my kids in not the best education system. And it was real for me because Singapore was home. So this was real. And hence, I personally sort of doubled down on, so how do I fill that gap? Because moving to India means the school system is not going to be able to provide that for them. And that is where my journey as an educator began. So I started by reading books and doing things. And, you know, my older child was my guinea pig. I think she's now 14. I would say I've only done good and not much damage. When I look at her, it gives me that confidence. But that's where my journey began. Very soon, the first couple of years of living coming back and living in Mumbai, I think becoming a parent also made me a lot more observant to what was happening to other kids. And, you know, the fact and even curiosity about what was happening with other kids. And I think 2 years after moving here, at some point, I walked into some of the slums, you know, where my maids were coming from, and just out of curiosity that what's happening with these kids. And what I saw there was just like heartbreaking. Like I suddenly realized that I was living in this world of, worry about what would happen for my child. Whereas actually she was already getting the best, and she was capable of getting the best because I could pay for the best school here. But what was available to these kids was so far away. And I think that's where the journey for me as an educator and the lead journey began. At some point in, during that year, I decided, okay, I'm not going to sit back and just complain about this. I want to be part of the solution. I've got to be responsible for not the 2 kids that are biologically born to me, but for more kids to get excellent education. And let me figure out what part I will play. That's where the journey began in 2010. And first 2 years, I set up an NGO and I ran an NGO. And then in 2012, the journey of lead sort of began.
Amazing. And that's, it's almost a decade now. And people haven't heard about lead until recently, I would say, because of the fundraising stories and because of all the attention that the startup ecosystem has got. So there's so much to unpack in that, 10-year journey. And talking about the genesis phase, what was the point, when you were still experimenting or, you started that NGO that you decided you want to make this your life's work?
Yeah, I think the trigger for that was prior to the NGO. I would say 2 things, right? One is the deep pain I experienced when I saw what I saw. I recall that day when I went, that particular day when I went, it was a rainy season. When I walked into the Anganwadi, see, my older kid was a preschooler at the time. When I walked into the Anganwadi, I saw a 4-year-old kid clean that place. And as a parent, I was very shaken when I saw that. And because it was a rainy season, there was a lot of muck and clogginess in the, on the street. And I came back and I was personally very disturbed because I had to walk through that muck. And, I came and I cleaned up and I was like, I had a bit of skin rash. And, all of that made me just sort of realize that, hey, reality is so different from these fancy places that we are living in. And that just shook me up. So I think that was one, that was the instance where I committed to myself that I have to play some role to change this reality for as many people as I can. I'm a realist. I'm not a dreamer. I have now learned to, of course, dream bigger because I've realized that I can actually make dreams come true, my own dreams come true. But at that time, I was a very hardcore realist. So I used to think, even 10 kids, it's okay. But whatever I can do. And I think the second part of that was I stepped away from PNG for 3 years and I was just doing consulting and some other work. I was spending time with my kids. And I think I had a lot of time to both self-reflect and immerse, sort of do some thinking and work around what is it that I want to do. If you recall, I mentioned I knew finance was never my calling. I was good at it, but I did not feel inspired by it. And there were some immersions I did, and I realized that what I used to call as my retirement plan need not be a retirement plan. I mean, if that's what gives me joy, then that is what I should do. So education gave me joy. It was challenging. I'm a person who loves challenges. I like to solve complex problems. I don't like easy things. It gave me both emotional joy and a challenge that I could solve or get into. And I think that's where, my commitment to this has come. I see this as the rest of my life, because I think it will be many more, at least in India, it is a couple of generations before we get to the desired place. I don't think in my lifetime I can solve it, not only alone. I mean, even with everyone, I don't see all of the education problem in India getting solved. And hence 12 years is nothing actually. I think it's the next, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 years. I don't know how many years I live, but that's what I see myself doing.
Smita, I think that's a great commitment and definitely an inspiration. And like you said, you know, it's a big challenge. And if you also look at, you know, the kind of edtechs that have come up recently, you know, they're focusing still on the top 20% of the population. And with LEED, you know, it is in a very unique position and it has chosen to solve for that massive, you know, challenging problem. And you're right, you know, there is a clear divide and that divide has increased further after COVID. So what are the trends that you've seen, you know, through your lens, through this journey over the past decade, pre-COVID, you know, how is it shaping up post-COVID? And maybe you can weave in, you know, how LEED's journey also evolved along the way, because you must have pivoted or thought about your solution in different ways, you know, as the ecosystem evolved.
No, I think, Digjay, you set the context very, very fairly. See, there are 260 million students, school-going students in India. And as you rightly said, only some 10 million or so are getting really good education. And what I mean by very good education, they go to great schools. There is, you know, true skill building that's happening. And, you know, these are the kids who also have access to a lot of the now edtech solutions that are available, you know, which have of course come up only over the last 10 years or so. Beyond those 10 million, they are unaffordable. And a lot of what the B2C edtech players land up doing is they land up, you know, solving the problem outside of the school system, which sort of, you know, assumes that the school systems can't be fixed. And if we really want sustainable and transformational change, we have no choice but to work with the school system. And that is, you know, simply because kids are going there. They are spending 6 hours a day, 6 days a week. That's, you know, that is 60% of their life. They are spending that time in school. And the deepest and the most transformative work can be done if we can make that extremely meaningful. You know, so that was the starting point for us at LEED. That is why when I was doing the nonprofit work in the first 2 years, I was working with government Anganwadis, seeing how I can transform that system. I very quickly realized my own limitation in having patience in working with the government and perseverance to go and keep talking to the bureaucrats. I see that as my limitation, honestly. I have immense regard for those who continue to persist in that journey, you know, and I do want to at some point pick that back again. But the reason why I went the for-profit setup our school way is because I always believe that transformation is needed for us to bring high-quality learning, and it can only be done through schools. And if it's going to take me so long to work with the government schools, let me just set up a school. And that's where I started. So we set up a school in 2012 in a village in Gujarat. We didn't know this is where we will come, you know, where LEED is today, where we'll be working with thousands of schools. Honestly, at that time, we didn't. We kept it simple. We said, you know, let's do one school, then let's learn, then maybe a few more, then let's learn, and then we'll see. We will see. That's all. And, you know, that's where we began. I think, see, the other part is that if we just go a little deeper, what is the challenge in education? I think there is enough that's been published that there are massive learning outcome gaps. You know, grade 5 kids not being able to do grade 3 math, them not being able to read grade 3 text, forget about English language, even in their own language. So foundational skills are missing. And again, that has to get fixed at the school level. It's going to be very tough for it to get fixed outside of school, especially if there is already so much of money that's gone into the school ecosystem, whether the government is spending it or the parent is spending it. So I think that's the overall view of the ecosystem. I think there is still a lot of work that needs to happen on the school side, both on the private school side and the government school side.
Right. So, you know, given this backdrop and the problem statement that you just mentioned, you know, what's going to be the focus for, you know, you as LEED, and what's the mission that you're, you know, driving forward?
See, for LEED, the mission when we set up LEED and even now has always been to provide excellent education and make it accessible and affordable. So by design, we're saying that we want to democratize high quality education. For it to be excellent, it has to be in school. So we will continue to work with more and more schools. Currently, we work with affordable private schools. I see us scaling that significantly from the current 4,500 odd schools that we work with to, you know, 60,000-70,000 private schools. There are further lower fee schools. We want to go down to that segment. We, of course, you know, want to explore and see, can we partner with the government and work with government schools? In the past, you know, some 8 years back, we have experimented with that. You know, that unfortunately didn't work out the way we wanted and the way the government, you know, was looking at it at that time. But now the government is becoming a lot more open to public-private partnerships. So I think that's the long sort of, that's the journey where the deep transformation work happens at schools. And of course, as we bring more and more students onto our platform and, you know, onto within the LEAD family, then what else can we do for them beyond school, or what can we do for them to achieve their dreams will, you know, will become questions that we start answering as we go forward. Now, if I also connect this back to the other question that you were asking, right, pre-COVID and post-COVID. See, the thing is that, you know, that COVID has actually bring forth certain fundamental issues with our system. And I think that's good because they have surfaced up, right? And when things surface up, people solve for it. COVID has finally surfaced up the conversation of learning outcomes. You know, someone recently asked me in the GSV event, you know, COVID has caused learning loss. How are you guys going to help fill that? And I said, you know, our kids always had learning gaps. And LEAD was always helping kids get past the learning gaps and get to grade level. And, you know, COVID has further perpetuated that problem. But there was an existing problem. I think the conversation of learning outcomes has come high on top, which is, I think, great for the ecosystem. Second thing that has happened with COVID is that you know, schools, while, you know, India largely is becoming very tech enabled. I mean, you even go to your Kirana retail store and he now, you know, has an app and takes an order and will send, you know, send delivery to your place. You don't have to call him or walk down to the Kirana store. Schools have continued to be analog. They are, you know, the only SMEs that have actually not, you know, started using technology. And I think that is the second thing that sort of came up. So I don't think there is a digital divide from the place that they don't have access because of affordability. They don't have access because no one thought about it. And I think that is now starting to get solved. So I would say COVID has done two good things, which is bring forth the two problems that have always plagued this ecosystem, the school ecosystem.
No, and you're right. And problem was always there. It's just that we're talking about it more. Two things clearly stand out for me when I think about LEAD. One is, of course, the market focus, the underserved semi-urban, you know, rural population that you're focusing on. And second is the B2B business model of partnering with schools, you know, actually taking them along in this journey versus trying to compete for students' time outside of school. And, you know, it clearly takes, there's something differentiating about LEAD that you brought in to, you know, to make this successful at scale. So, you know, if you could talk about that, when you look back at that journey, what do you think was critical in being able to scale both these aspects and be successful at that?
Yeah, see, I think the one most basic thing I will say is that, see, I was a school owner myself. When I started this journey, I did not start by saying that I will, you know, change the ecosystem in such a big manner. I think today, sitting today, it's a privilege for me to be able to say that, hey, we can make a dent in the ecosystem. Back then, I was just a school owner. And as a school owner, within the first year of my operations, I was aware that I had no help. Whenever I was trying to look at solutions outside, whether it was publishers, whether it was Smart Class, whether it was any technology, I had essentially three problems. One, they were not designed for these students and these teachers. What do I mean by these students and these teachers? Basically, non-metro, non-English speaking background, low capability teachers, and an ecosystem where the teacher is just loaded with a lot of work. Right. So it was not designed for this ecosystem. Second is it was all just not affordable. It was expensive. And third is, you know, it was disintegrated. And what I mean by disintegrated is that I, as a school owner, had to buy four different things that were not talking to each other. And somehow I had to sit with my principal and figure out how to piece it together. So whatever we built as the lead integrated system, honestly, was born out of necessity. Basically, as a school owner, I said, I have to piece it together. And then once I started piecing it together, I didn't find the efficacy or the quality to be good enough for achieving the learning outcomes. And hence, we said, we'll just build it. So I think, you know, if I with that backdrop, I think the three things that we do well, because of which we, you know, have a very high positive impact once implemented in a school. One is that our curriculum is designed for teaching at the right level and acceleration from there. So we recognize that learning gaps are real and we don't accept that the learning gaps will continue. We take it upon ourselves and say, hey, we want our kids to get to their grade level just like their peers in metros. Irrespective of their context, we want them to be performing at the level of kids who are coming to the metro schools. So our entire curriculum was designed for that. Second, we designed for simplicity for the teacher because this teacher leads a very complex life. You know, she wakes up at 5 in the morning and does all her home chores, then comes and does this job where out of 8 periods in a school, she's teaching 6 periods. She has very little time. And then she goes back home and then does the rest, right? So we said we've got a design for this teacher, something that is so simple that it actually makes her a great teacher. And, you know, that was the second thing that we did in the way we designed our technology. And the third is basically, you know, how do we integrate everything so that there is systemic change and systemic improvement? So that we don't have to go and tell 5 different stakeholders in a school, you know, you should do this and you should do that because, you know, it's very tough for them. And I think these are the things that have really helped us deliver on outcomes. And it also gave us the confidence to talk about outcomes. I think we're the only one who actually goes and talks to the school owner saying that, hey, this is the amount of student learning improvement that you will see. This is the amount of teacher learning improvement you will see. We will, you know, we will assure you of that. And if not, then we will take accountability for it. And I don't think the school owners had ever heard that. And we could say that because we were school owners. You know, we were not vendors who were trying to sell. So I think that is what has led to the growth. Of course, you know, there are a lot of other things that one does. But I mean, at the core of it, I would say these were the reasons why we have been able to scale this.
Yeah, I think it's a classic, you know, first principles approach, you know, facing the problem yourself, you could see it with a very, I would say, authentic lens to, you know, see how you can solve for it in its true sense and keeping outcomes in mind. And yeah, just staying close to the customer and bringing all stakeholders together, which again, I think, you know, not all edtechs have dared to do, like with schools especially, because like you said, it brings in different stakeholders, you know, teachers, students, as well as the administration that is running the school. So, you know, having that first principle lens and being close to the customer, having experienced that problem yourself, I think those are some key cues, you know, for founders to take from here, just in terms of how do you scale this, especially keeping the semi-urban rural population in mind. Smita, with that, you know, I want to talk about the growth aspect. And you mentioned, right, the trajectory has been slow at first. You wanted to take your time, realize what you want to build. You started with first school, 2017, I think you were still at 5. And you grew to about 4,500 to 5,000 schools in 2022. You know, how do you think about growth as a startup or as a company now? And there are so many levers that you can, you know, pull or focus on to accelerate or bring about that growth. So just want to talk about from your perspective, right? What were the key levers that you focused on, you know, to get that kind of growth? And what were also some of the challenges that you think you faced as a startup, you know, when you were scaling from the, you know, de facto model to a very hyper growth model?
No, it's a good question. And it is, I can think of so many things, but I'll try and pick the most important ones that might be relevant, right, for people to learn from. See, I think on the key levers, I think the first one I described or I spoke about, I think it's important to have, before you start scaling, it is important to have what typically people would say strong product market fit. Now, what that essentially means is, what is the problem you're trying to solve? You know, in a small ecosystem, designing and learning your way and tweaking your way through it. You know, sometimes I find agile can be misused. You know, it is very tough to be agile at scale. You can't be. And when you are trying to be agile at scale, you burn lots of people, you know, along the way, especially your consumers, which you don't want to do. And especially in certain sectors like education and healthcare, you know, you can't really experiment too much because it is important for you to ensure that there is, you know, these are sensitive things. You can't cause damage. So I think the first would be, the first big lever would be that by the time, see, in 2017, we were bootstrapped. You know, we were running at that time 9 schools, you know, 4 were our own schools. We had a couple of partners. So we had experimented with the partnership model. And we were also at that time doing some school government partnership. But essentially, there were 9 schools where the system was running, the teachers were teaching. And, you know, and hence we had and we had some phenomenal student progress and teacher improvement. So we had a lot of this live data that was telling us that this is working before we started scaling. And that's when we raised institutional money. In some ways, it was good that we were bootstrapped because we were answerable to ourselves. So we were very focused on only one stakeholder. And that stakeholder for us was the child, to be very honest. You know, and we were not clouded by the school owner's, you know, voice and the shareholder voice as such. That is something that came up later. I think the second one was the way at least we work, Sumit and me work, there are two things fundamental to how we work, right? One is we are very systems thinker. We are not necessarily ideas people only. So we are like, okay, if you want to have this impact, how does it impact the ecosystem? What are all the different things that will get impacted? And we'll work holistically across that. It you know, working in schools particularly is complex. Schools are complex ecosystems. B2B is complex than B2C. You know, and in a school environment, we are looking at multiple stakeholders, student, teacher, coordinator or principal, school owner and parent. Now I have to take care of all 5 people. So our tech also is complex. Everything that we do, we have to think of all 5 stakeholders. So everything that we build or we have been building, we think about the entire system and then we take it forward. And I would say the third thing is the way we scale or we have scaled is we've done things, new things in small ecosystem. And then we've basically looked at what is the replicable model? You know, you get to a place where you're comfortable that this model can get replicated and then you replicate. So let me give you an example of what that means. So, you know, in terms of the product or what I call the integrated system, I already described that, you know, we were in 9-10 schools. Operationally, we knew how it is going to be. That's when we went out next. Now, the second port of call for us when we raised our money and, you know, when we said we'll go the partnership route was to actually see what does partnership mean here? What does this interaction and this GTM look like? And, you know, there was a lot of different experiments we did. And I think we did those for at least 2 to 3 years as we went from, in the first year, we thought we'll sign 10, 12 schools. We signed 35 schools. The next year we went to 150, then we went to 800, then 2000, and then now 4,500. Now it has meant that our GTM has gone through changes, but we were able to change and improve because we could, we had a clear playbook and we kept documenting and saying that, hey, this is the playbook, right? And every year we now go back and we tweak and perfect parts of it. And, you know, that's the mindset. You know, I'm just demonstrating a mindset right with this. For example, we did the same for our service model, right? So we said, you know, in small town India, only product does not work. You have to provide a certain layer of service. So in 2018, we created an excellence model, an academic excellence model. And the first 3 or 4 people who joined us, who continue to be part of our team, I recall my conversation with them. I told them, see, this year is going to be chaos, but the 4 of us have to make sense of this chaos. So we will keep connecting and writing a playbook about how this will work, because we'll make lots of mistakes this year. And then we will scale the model, you know, and we did that. And I mean, those three, four people are very senior leaders in the organization now. But essentially, that's the approach that we've taken to scale.
I think that's, you know, a lot of clarity. And I think you use the right word, it's chaos, you know, when you're growing. but making it organized chaos is tough. And having the right feedback loops, you know, driving you to go from gear one to gear two to gear three when you're in that growth mode probably becomes, you know, the decisive factor in, you know, how fast or how successful you can, you know, take this at scale. Great clarity there, Smita. If you were to point out one or two things, what was the most challenging aspect?
Challenges, yeah. No, that's fair. Yeah, that was a question I missed. You know, see, there are two challenges that come to mind, but both, I think we are sort of past that, right? I think one challenge in the early years was skepticism. There is, you know, unfortunately, in the school industry or school space, there are people who've come in the past who've either not succeeded or who have not maybe operated their businesses or scaled their businesses in a manner that is investable and have burnt investors, right? I mean, we know the Edicom story, and then there were a few others, you know, after that who were unable to scale. So there was definitely skepticism. Founders, we're always optimistic people. I mean, we have to be, right? We basically believe that the world is going to be different and we are going to make it different. So, you know, whenever the, you know, whoever used to look at the rear view mirror and say, hey, they couldn't do it, you know, the way I would always look at it is, yeah, I will constantly look at them and not make the same mistake. But they couldn't do it does not mean no one can do it. So I think that skepticism was something that we, you know, had to sort of battle in the beginning. Maybe that was also the reason why we chose to be bootstrapped. We said, you know, why bother? We'll just do what we need to do. And then we got very lucky that we met Elevar very early because they do very first principles thinking themselves. So they were not carrying the baggage. They, of course, were asking all the right questions, but they were not carrying the baggage. But in the process, and even after that, I've met so many investors who will always look at the rear view mirror. And I think that's the interesting thing that I've seen, that those who see the rear view mirror and just are looking for companies that are this for that, you know, someone else has done it and then now you'll do it. You know, you'll invest in one sort of companies. It's not wrong, but you'll invest in one sort of companies, right? But those who are first principles thinkers, where they see there is a problem, I recognize and I fundamentally know that this problem needs to get solved, you know, and I can see that this team can do it and is on to something good, will look at things differently. So I think that was one. Like, I recall my discussion with Westbridge Sandeep Singhal. You know, we completely resonated on the fact that he said, hey, schools will never close, right? Forever schools will exist. If that is the case, then, you know, you guys are best placed to solve this. And I was like, exactly. So, you know, we can keep talking about B2C EdTech as much as we want, but that is never going to be the full answer to the solution of education. Right. So I think skepticism, I think the second biggest challenge that we faced and which finally is behind us is COVID. I mean, I think the last 2 years, I think have been the most challenging that I would have experienced in my entire lifetime. And I think for many, many people, and challenging because of the fact that it just brought to fore the fact that we don't think about learning outcomes. And hence, as a nation, we were perfectly okay for schools to be shut for 2 years. We are the only country, or we are the longest, or India had the longest lockdowns of schools. And again, there is a pattern. You look at those countries who are high on PISA rankings, they have not allowed their schools to be shut. I think this was very challenging for us because we basically were hitting our growth period. We were just doing our Series C. I recall we were about to launch our fundraise and the banker had to hold it off because COVID happened. And then we said, we will still go ahead and we will make things work despite COVID. We're not going to get stopped. And, you know, we never looked back because the internal conversation we had was, we will use this as an opportunity because we don't want any learning loss to happen. So if we are not there for the kids, who is? If we are not there for the school owners, who is? And I think that mindset helped our team really get very innovative. I mean, we launched a Lead School at Home program in 5 days of the lockdown. So our kids never miss school. You know, and that has also allowed us to sort of ramp up. So turning that adversity into an opportunity was definitely tough. I think, I mean, we didn't have answers. We just went with a lot of faith and the fact that, hey, we'll just do it. Yeah? And we are smart people. If all of us put our heads together, we'll do it. So I mean, those are, I think, the two challenges for us. The growth and the COVID story are not separate, simply because we had to grow despite COVID challenges. Now that it's gone, I think growing is a little easier.
Yeah, no, amazing, Smita. And I think that also speaks to the culture and, you know, the DNA that you have, and you've been able to pass it on to the team at Lead as well, you know, as you grew up. And that's something which I also want to, you know, touch upon. I clearly sense, you know, the mission, the passion that you want to solve for education in India. But it's not always easy to find people like yourself, right? Especially when you are embarking on a mission. And like you mentioned earlier, you know, there's so much skepticism with what happened in the past. It's difficult to get on board good skilled people with the same passion. So, you know, what did you over-index on, right, when you were hiring the initial team? Because that strong foundation is necessary to, you know, build something as you know, Lead is today. So what were some things that you over-indexed on? And maybe a follow-up would be, what do you look for in general now today, you know, when you're hiring candidates at Lead School?
I think over-indexing on value alignment has always been very, very important for us. What I mean by value alignment is, how do we operate? You know, because ultimately when you're working together, it's the daily how is very, very important beyond the what. You know, so we operate with the value of high integrity. We operate with the value of growth mindset. We operate with the value of being the cause. Being the cause is, hey, there are lots of problems in the world. What are you going to do about it? I mean, the whole genesis of Lead was that, you know, and so we definitely, at least at the senior leadership level, we have always highly over-indexed on value alignment. Second is mission alignment. Now, in mission alignment, the way we've over-indexed is, you know, I've found two things happen as I've interacted with people eventually who've joined us. One is you land up meeting people who also are pained by the same problem, who also see the same thing. It has hit a nerve somewhere and hence would want to be part of the solution. But then you meet people who, through the process of interaction with you, get really, really inspired by the mission. And they see themselves actually working on it for a long time to come. So I think that we allow that space because, you know, when people are looking for roles, everyone is not in a place that, hey, you know, I will do good and, you know, for the community and for myself. We're unfortunately not raised to think that you can do both. And actually, you can do both. You know, Sumit keeps saying again and again within the organization that you focus on Saraswati and Lakshmi will follow, which is, I think Lead is a great example. We had no goal of being a unicorn or whatever, right? Our goal was student outcome. Everything else followed. So I think, you know, it's okay to, I've learned to be very flexible about that, but then discover that in the process of interactions, if at the end of it, and I ask this pointed question, actually, especially to anyone who's going to come at a leadership level, that how do you see yourself playing a role in this mission? And if that is an authentic response, and I know that the person has traversed that journey, but, you know, if the authentic response is, hey, it is one thing, but not the most important thing, then we've also had the tough conversation that, you know, this will come in the way of us working because I will come from a place of extreme passion on this and we will struggle on decision-making, you know, because we'll start negotiating on decisions. So I think that is the second thing that we over-index on. I think what is table stakes in any case is expertise in your domain of work. You know, Sumit and me ourselves come from a place where we expect high quality of work from ourselves. We expect that from everyone, you know. Excellence with velocity is one of our values. If anyone asks me, you know, I can either do high quality work or I could do it fast, then I'm like, no, yeah, then it doesn't work. It has to be both, right? So high quality work is also the expertise in whatever area. I would say these are the things. Rest, especially skills, you can always build skills, but value alignment is very tough to build, you know, and that is something that we hold close. That is even now at scale at all levels of hiring.
Right. No, I think that clarity and, you know, you as a founder, you know, thinking through that, you know, as deeply as you just laid it out, that's also important, you know, to attract that right kind of talent and bring that kind of alignment, especially at the leadership roles, you know, when you're scaling a company. All right. So Smita, you briefly touched upon, you know, the investors and how lucky you were to partner with some of the investors you've, you know, partnered with. Also observed that, you know, you've been very selective partnering with the investors that you have. You don't have a huge cap table when it comes to, you know, institutional investors. So want to understand, you know, what was the criteria, one, to choose to partner with the investors that you have, you know, GSV, LFR, and Westbridge, and what kind of value add is each of them bringing, you know, to the table, especially as you in this journey where you're now going to hyperscale?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question. It was a process of thinking and discovery, you know, for us in the beginning, but that has held us in good stead till now. You know, I keep going back to the criteria to see, do we need to change the criteria as we go forward? But our three simple criteria when we did Series A and even till now that we had was, one, is there mission alignment? It is important because we want all stakeholders to be on the same page with us, because otherwise we will get pulled in different directions and that's not going to help the organization. So that I think was very important. See, we're an organization where one of our topmost goal or metric that we look at on our company scorecard is student outcome data. You know, so it was important that any investor who comes in actually also feels strongly about it. Otherwise, you know, my board meetings will all get distracted into different things. So I think mission alignment was one. Second was, can the investor do follow-on rounds and be part of this journey over a longer duration? It was a very simple reason for us to make that a metric, because we as founders love education. We love solving education problems and building this organization. Fundraising is not something that we really enjoy. So we also said, you know, we want to bring on people who will do follow-on rounds. And I think it helped us because, you know, we did Series B without sort of, we did nothing outside. We never spoke to anyone. It just allowed us to scale very rapidly. Through COVID, we had very strong backing from our investors. So it allowed us to take the risk on growth. So I think that really helped, right? And the third is, who is the individual and who are the, you know, who are the people that we're working with? Is that person a founder or a founder mindset? So it's an interesting pattern. You would notice that on all three, so, you know, when LFR came, it was Sandeep and Jyotsna who are founding, members. They're key decision makers. After that, Westbridge came. It was Sandeep Singhal, who is the founder of Westbridge amongst the two founders. And then when GSV came on board, it was Deb. They're as committed to the journey and they get us, right? Because they are founders themselves. And there is so much that we can learn from them. This one, the third criteria is going to be tough as we go forward. But yeah, it has held us in good stead. And I think that brings me to, you know, what is, how have they added value? I think, LFR joined us at a place where we were first going to go out and, you know, sort of try out the partnership model, right? So we needed someone who was as much in love with the problem and also had as much conviction and faith in our ability to be able to do it. And LFR absolutely hands down brought that. They were always by our side, which gave us the space to experiment and like, take up risks and do things. They were not sort of pulling us in a different direction or questioning us. They were by our side. Now, I know if you talk to Sandeep and Jyotsna, you'd also say that Sumit and me are not maverick founders. We are reasonable in the way we make decisions, but well, while they give us credit, I would also give them credit for that, right? So I think they did that. And then, you know, when we wanted to scale very rapidly, we had two choices, that we scale slowly, we do another round externally, or we scale rapidly and they funded internally. And they, like, it was a 20-minute conversation that we had over a meeting, right? And we just decided, we said, let's not waste time trying to raise money externally. So I think they played a huge role there. And they were always very, very good thought partners in that phase of the journey from the Series A to Series D, Sandeep Farias particularly and Jyotsna particularly, right? If I come to Westbridge are now playing that role for the next phase because they understand this scaling journey, you know, and Sandeep Singhal, there is a lot of thought partnering that we get from him. They have a much larger view of what's happening around in the world. And also Sandeep Singhal himself, his ability to look at the big picture is just phenomenal. And Westbridge has done multiple follow-up rounds with us, you know, follow-on rounds. And they are long-term investors. They are not ones who are very locked into exiting quickly. So I think that helps. GSV was an interesting one. We were not raising money. They connected with us. And we actually learned about them in the process of interacting with them. I think GSC Trust is, Deb, I mean, one, I think I have immense admiration for her. I think she is just one of the best connectors I've seen in the world. I mean, she knows everyone. And she's just so warm, and she just knows how to build relationships. I think the entire GSV ecosystem allows us to really broaden our horizons in terms of learning and understanding what's happening around in the world. And also now that we've scaled, for us to really look at and forge partnerships where we can use our existing platform and network of schools and really bring them a world of possible sort of learning solutions, which we may not build internally. I think that's just phenomenal for the ecosystem, and it is phenomenal for our students because, I mean, ultimately our mission is excellent outcome for these kids, you know, on par with kids from metros. And I'm under no false belief that we'll build everything ourselves. I think now LEAD is more a vehicle or a way in which some phenomenal things can be brought to schools and school owners. And, you know, the GSV Summit was a great example of that. I mean, we met so many amazing product companies and founders. And there are some 6 different experiments that we are running over the next 3 months in some of our schools for us to see which one actually adds a lot of value for our school owners or for our students, which we will then scale. And I think, you know, that is credit to GSV.
Awesome. I think as in when we're going further with the conversation, there are so many new original insights, you know. It's, I think, a very classic, keep it simple view of fundraising. It's end of the day, of course, the value add means a lot, and which is what you over-indexed on. You know, you just chose the right partners.
I must caveat it by saying that these are principles, that decision-making criteria that we came up with. It is not the answer for everyone. I think, you know, yeah, we had the privilege of, or we started this company after we had already sort of earned a bit and saved. So we had the opportunity to invest in our own company. You know, some of the founders who start much earlier don't have that, and hence they have to do angel round. So I think it's important to, yeah. But I think just by my only advice or takeaway from this would be, it's very, very important to think through this and write down for yourself. This is my decision-making criteria, because when you get into the fundraise mode and you're talking to people, there is just a lot of noise. You'll hear so much and you'll hear from so many people. So how do you choose? And it is important that you choose, because there is the check is the most important thing, but then, the color of the ink on that check and everything else is also important once you start working together.
No, absolutely agree. Siddharth, moving on, you know, and before we jump into our final segment, which is a rapid fire, one question, you know, that I like asking a lot of, you know, guests on the podcast. It's a long, you know, arduous journey, right? Being a founder, you need a lot of energy, you need a lot of positivity along the way. And along the way, you know, you discover yourself, learn so much about yourself during that journey. So, you know, how has being an entrepreneur or a founder influenced your personality, you know, over the last decade or so?
Yeah. Okay. This is a very interesting question, Digjay. I think it made me sort of go back, rewind, and reflect a lot. See, I think one thing is, pre-starting LEAD or pre-starting the founder journey, I would say when I was doing a job at PNG, you know, I was a lot more fixed mindset. You know, and when I say fixed mindset versus growth mindset, I am using the framework of Carol Dweck on how she describes. Fixed mindset is very focused on your achievements, focus on whether you're doing well or not. When people are giving you feedback, you're wondering whether they're criticizing you or what's happening, right? And you also see yourself as finite. Like, you see that, hey, this is what I'm good at and this is what I need to do. And, you know, I also grew up in that context that, oh, you're choosing finance. So that is what you're going to do for the rest of your life. And it was pathbreaking work when I read Growth Mindset, I think, in the very early parts of choosing to work in education. And I think that is one big shift, because as a founder, you basically, as an entrepreneur, you get beaten 90-95% of the time, right? And you just have to basically focus only on learning and not anything else. So I think I have transitioned significantly from being fixed mindset to being growth mindset. I was a finance professional in some part of my life. And then I became an educator and teacher. And now I've become like a, you know, CEO of a large company. Again, these things I had not done before, but I just don't shy away from making mistakes, taking feedback, learning, moving on. I don't live with guilt, have self-doubt. those were not things that, I mean, I used to have self-doubt before I started this. Now I'm like, whatever happens, I will solve it. It's okay. It's okay if I've made a mistake, I will not repeat the mistake, you know? So I think that is one big shift in personality. For my friends who knew me, especially from college, they were actually like, you know, you're not even the same person anymore. So I think that was one. And I think the second thing is just resilience. And I would say, especially the last 2-3 years with COVID and also, you know, building this company while as a parent, I had 2 very young kids because I started this when my older one was 2.5 years old. My younger one was just less than a year. And, you know, as a parent, there are lots of ups and downs that you go with your kids, right? They have illnesses. There are things that happen in the family, right? And like anyone, we have also gone through it. I think just doing that and not giving up on our mission and our, desire to also nurture and grow lead, I think I just have immense resilience. So now I've also am in a place where whatever challenge hits me, you know, I'm always solution oriented. I can also now see that how when COVID happened, I was in the place that worst things have happened in my life. So we just have to figure out how. So I think that is one big shift. And I think all founders, my sense is all of us who have been on this journey long enough are just amazingly resilient.
Resilient.
We can also come across as then people who don't give up. But I see it as a good thing, you know. I think there was twice in this journey where there were existential questions on whether we can even continue or not. But it was never an existential question in my mind. I said, no, we're continuing. It's a time to rethink and pivot, you know, and that's okay. But that does not mean we're not solving the problem. The problem is real. So I think that's the second big personality change. See, the third one, which I don't, which people who know me very well within the organization know, but I don't talk about it as much publicly, but I'm okay for it to be on this podcast. I am an introvert. I don't like media attention. And for the longest time, actually, I used to have only Sumit talk publicly. I used to just delegate. Some of my team members used to always say, why don't we see you outside? And I think the last 1 year or so, I've made a concerted effort now, to also sort of be socially a little more active externally, because I've realized that it's important that, the lead voice, both from Sumit and me, because we are different individuals, we think about some of the things differently, is out there for people. So I think that's the third one. I'm still working on that.
Amazing, Smita. Yeah, and you're right. You know, people need to listen to the story, because every founder journey is unique in itself. And, you know, there's a lot of context, a lot of situations that each founder goes through differently. But having broken so many stereotypes along the way and the way you've approached solving the problem, I think it's going to inspire a lot of other entrepreneurs and women entrepreneurs as well, you know, which is what we need more as we are growing in this ecosystem as well.
Vijay, I would add that I actually for the longest time stayed away from any woman entrepreneur, woman founder thing. I have the strong belief that, hey, I want people to associate with me as an entrepreneur, as a founder, as a professional, as a teacher, without my gender tag. But I've also actually loosened up a lot on it over the last 1.5-2 years when, few of the women in our organization spoke to me and said, hey, while that's how you think about it, it's important for other women to hear how you overcame the challenges so that they can learn from it. And I realized that, you know, my view on not talking about it, you know, was actually a lot more rigid, and I became, you know, much more open. But my dream really is that we women do get referred to as our work without the gender tag, because I don't hear male entrepreneur, but I hear woman entrepreneur. I'm like, why? You know, just gender doesn't make us unique in any way. You know, we are professionals ourselves. So that's my dream and my hope that we'll get there.
No, I absolutely agree, Smita. And we are working and hopefully going in that direction, you know, slowly and gradually. Okay, Smita, we'll switch into our rapid fire. I'll shoot some questions and, you know, hope to get your honest, immediate thoughts on the same.
Okay.
First question, one thing that you'd like to change to improve the state of the Indian startup ecosystem?
I think the one thing is I would really urge for everyone in the ecosystem to not focus on the metrics of how much money has been raised in the valuation, which I see as lag metrics or vanity metrics. I think your true outcome metrics, whichever customer segment you are servicing, whichever problem you're trying to solve, I think those are, I would love for people to talk about those metrics. Like in education, it would be about what is the learning outcome impact? How many students are you impacting? I mean, we're doing what we're doing and at very large impact, but suddenly people talk about us after we've become a unicorn. And that was not a metric we were ever chasing. So I would love for that to change.
Absolutely agreed. Okay, next question. If you had to give a TED talk, what topic would you choose and why?
Okay, one, I don't think I will ever land up going on a TED talk because I was telling you that's like outside of my comfort zone. But
yeah, maybe that changes with time, Smita.
That changes with time, right? Never say never. But if there's one thing, I would talk about design for excellence versus design for incremental growth or what I call design for poverty. What I mean by that is, I think very often in the environment, and I take education itself, when there is a very big problem and there is big differentiation in what some kids have and what many don't, very often solutioning starts becoming, oh, they don't have this much, let's give them a little more. And I don't think that brings transformational change. I think transformation happens when you say, I want to give them the same or make available the same that's available to the rich. Then let's start thinking about how. The best example I can give is coding. For the longest time, for the last 4 years, we believe that coding belongs in schools and it belongs as a core life skill because that's where the world is moving. You know, we took an internal target that coding should be one part of school curriculum. And the price point at which we need to do it is parent is currently spending 100 rupees on a computer science book. We can only replace that because the parent does not have space for more.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time I told this to the team, they were shocked, but they came back and they've designed a solution. And now coding and computational thinking skills is a part of core curriculum at LEED at that price point. So they do what kids would otherwise do with fancy B2C programs, right? And I think that is what I mean by design for excellence. There are numerous stories from within LEED where we have designed for excellence for that consumer segment versus designing for poverty or designing for incremental growth.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you can't bring about transformational change with that approach. And it also speaks to, you know, LEED's DNA and culture, you know, just shifting the benchmark and shifting the perspective to, you know, where you want to get at versus something better than just the status quo. All right. Last question. VCs and founders from the ecosystem that you admire and look up to.
Okay. So, see, I can only talk about those who the VCs and founders I know, honestly, because, yeah, you know, everything else is fair media. You don't know people till you spend time with them. So enough. I would say, you know, in the founder list, of course, I would talk about Sumit, my co-founder. And I think the one thing I really, really admire about him is his sense of possibility. I think a lot of what we do at LEED comes from his sense of possibility. You know, he's that person who brings that, you know, and always challenges me too. So I think I admire that about him. Then about Sandeep, Farias and Jyotsna from Elevar, who I've worked with very closely. I would say, you know, just the organization they've built with a sense of purpose. I don't see customer understanding, consumer understanding, you know, of that segment and purpose that deeply embedded with VCs. Many of them talk about it, but truly in the way they understand the segment and the sort of companies hence that they sort of partner with, right? So I really admire that. I think that really makes them stand apart. I already mentioned about Deb. I think, I mean, I just admire her ability to connect with people, you know, just spread so much of warmth and build such close relationships with so many people. I am just really in awe of that. And Sandeep Singhal, I would say his ability to look at the big picture. Every time we talk and we spend time together, I find that like a whole new world of what all is possible and what's, you know, how to look at what LEED and what I could do sort of starts becoming much bigger. whether we are spending time on work or whether we're just spending time personally as friends, you know, both happen. And I really admire that. Others, very tough. I mean, on the outside, very, very tough because you only read about them. The only other thing I would add is this time in the summit, I met pretty much all of the founders of the leading edtech companies in India, the Indian founders. And I think it was just amazing to connect with them. I think such humble and amazing people, you know, very, very passionate about what they're doing. So that also made me realize that, you know, these metrics of fundraise and all, actually media tends to care about it. I did not see any of them care about it. So I could viscerally relate to them. We all were talking about the same thing here. How does it matter? You know, ultimately when fundraise happens, it's a matter of relief because you're moving on to your next phase of the journey. So it was very refreshing to see that. And, you know, of course, I have a lot of admiration for what they've built, you know, all of these guys. So
thanks. Thanks for, you know, sharing your honest thoughts and opinions with us throughout the podcast, not just the rapid fire. You know, before we sign off, you know, any last thoughts for both current and aspiring founders that are listening to you through the podcast?
What I would add is, and I hope you, you know, people extract that from our journey also, is that I would say become a founder if you deeply, deeply care about a problem, so much so that you're going to enjoy the pain of solving that problem, because an entrepreneurial journey is enjoying and working through pain. It is not joy. The joy is in seeing that problem getting solved. Everything else is just hearsay. Don't go in the flow of that, whether it is fundraise, whether it is attention from people, any of that, none of that really matters. I think that's the biggest thing. How much do you care about that problem? And are you willing to basically just work yourself off, you know, all the time? Because an entrepreneurial journey is just a test of resilience. It's a test of resilience. And for all those who are parents, if we as parents think that raising a kid is a test of resilience, well, building a company is many, many X more than that.
Yeah. And you've done both together, you know, at the time you became a parent and started Lead. So kudos to you and Sumit, you know, both. I think this was a very inspiring conversation. I've learned a lot from this. So thank you so much, Smita, first of all, for taking out the time. And yeah, hopefully we'll have you back on the show sometime soon again.
Thanks, Digjay. And I, you know, thank you for patiently listening. And this was a fun conversation today for me too. Thanks so much, yeah.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the VC Bruno podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please let our guests know about it. Share your thoughts on social media and let them know what were your key takeaways. We would truly appreciate if you could subscribe to our podcast on the podcast platform of your choice and leave us a review on Apple iTunes. This will help others discover the podcast. To get insights and to learn more about startups and venture capital, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We will love to hear from you there. You can find all episodes together on our website, thevcpreneur.com. We will be back again next week with another VCpreneur that is making a dent in the venture universe. Until then, take care and keep shining.